Okay, good morning. So last time we talked about port numbers, which were one of our missing pieces as far as what was sent on the network for dealing with, well, each machine has multiple programs that all want to use TCP or UDP. How does that actually work? Well, port numbers are how we tell which program is which. And we have to have this process where the operating system kind of provides an interface to the network and, you know, then filters out the messages and gets them in a way where the programs can understand them, and kind of de facto one that is used most of the time is this socket API that originated in sort of early versions of the Berkeley Standard Distribution of Unix, but pretty much everyone has copied this API, even if maybe it doesn't make all the best choices. And the API was, you know, designed to be very network generic, because at the time it was being developed, it wasn't clear that, you know, pretty much all the time we'd be using IP. So it has this concept of address families, which is useful in IP because IPv4 and IPv6 are different address families, but the idea is we can have other types of networking supported with the same interface. And it also has the same interface for UDP, which has this datagram abstraction, and TCP, which has the stream abstraction, and you just specify what type you want, and they try to map the basic receive and send operations to that abstraction, that interface, you know, the stream or the datagram interface. So with datagrams, each send and receive is sort of one datagram. With streams, send and receive, you know, gets split up in some unspecified way into segments because, you know, it's just a stream of bytes. We can send them in any sort of, you know, setup we want. And there's this way of configuring sort of extra settings in socket that's very generic again, called setSockOpt, where the idea is that not only does this support sort of miscellaneous settings for sockets in an extensible way where we just add new option types, it also supports options that are particular to specific protocols. So we saw one example is that this is where we can set a setting to say, you know, I don't like that TCP feature where you wait to try to fill up a segment, don't do that for me. You can set that on a socket by socket basis with setSockOpt, and there's other options. If you like look up the Linux man pages for TCP and IP, there's a ton of these for configuring various things or querying various things about your socket that don't fit in the sort of generic interface. You also mentioned the idea of server sockets. So a special case we need to deal with is servers where we're going to want multiple connections. And kind of our natural idea of a connection is that each connection would have its own socket, but then we need to get like lots of sockets for each connection. And the way that the socket API did this is that we have a special type of socket called a server socket that can accept connections, and each of those accept operations creates a new connection socket. And we talked a bit about, in the process of this, the TCP state machine. So we looked at when we're asking to connect a socket to create a socket, what's going on? And we saw with TCP, we had this three-way handshake. So we have this special flag to indicate we're starting a connection, and we make sure we get an acknowledgement before we let the connect operation complete, before we send any data. We learned that that's not like strictly necessary. You could send data earlier in a different protocol, and some different protocols do that. But TCP has made the choice that we verify the connection is set up properly before we send any bytes of data. And we also have this thing that TCP and other protocols need to deal with, which is how do we do connection close? And an issue with connection close is someone needs to send the last packet. And if you're sending the last packet, well, you can't get an acknowledgement of the last packet. So that means we need to sort of keep things around for the resending of the last packet. So whoever's not sending the last packet needs to sort of have this waiting period where they sort of reserve the port numbers just in case that packet is retransmitted. Questions about things we covered last time? Okay. So there was a question I will go over for the sake of the recording that was about came before a lecture about one of the test cases on the DNS assignment. And I'll take other questions. Okay. So there's a test case where we pass the address, where we ask to query the address alpha.beta.delta.gamma that a lot of people have trouble with. And what I'd like to point out is that there's a dot at the end of the test case. That is a valid DNS syntax. It's what dig outputs. It's what we saw in that format. You need to handle that. And it seems like it's a common bug for people not to realize that that's, you know, that this means that when we turn this into a DNS name, right, we expect it to have 1, 2, 3, 4 labels, not 5. And any questions on this or any other things about the DNS assignment? So I'm going to finish up talking about sockets, talk about something we can do with UDP that we've kind of seen a little bit, but we haven't seen the interface for, and we haven't seen one of the important applications of. And that's broadcast or multicast. So we've seen this with like DHCP. We said with DHCP, you send a packet to everyone on the local network. You know, you just send to the local network, to whoever. You don't have a specific destination in mind. And the socket API lets you do this with UDP as a normal application. So one way, so with IPv4, you can do broadcast to the local network. So there's a special IP address that's all ones that represents contact everyone on the current network. And to use it, you just use the set sock op to set SO broadcast to 1. Otherwise, the system by default assumes that if you try to broadcast, it's a mistake. And then you can send things and receive things from that broadcast address, that as long as your port number matches. So the port number is still checked on broadcast. You know, so it still matters. You're like, we aren't broadcasting to all port numbers, but we can receive things for this. And there's also multicast. So multicast is not broadcast to send to everybody. Multicast is sent to multiple people. And this is supported in both IPv4 and IPv6. And what they've decided to do is basically they've had these sets of addresses that are for multicast. And you can subscribe to one of these addresses. And this is actually supported both on local networks and non-local networks. I'm only talking on this slide about how it works on local networks. I'm not planning on actually going over multi-network multicast, though that is a real topic we could cover. But, you know, we're ignoring the routing problem, and routing multicast is not trivial and has some interesting, you know, specific routing challenges. And also, multicast on the internet, like, is a dream that has like never really been supported. It exists, but good luck finding an ISP who lets you do it. But on the local network, it's very common. So it's like broadcast, except you register that you want to receive it, so you don't sort of automatically get everything. And the idea is that we have some multicast addresses. So for local networks, we have these range of addresses that the administrator of the local network could potentially allocate to specific uses, and we can sort of separate our different uses to different addresses of these sorts. And as far as what is the system doing, like a way we can implement this is that we just filter the packets based on the destination IP, and we say, you know, if no one's asked to, you know, call IPv6 add membership and we receive a packet to FF02 something, we say, well, we don't need that packet. If someone has, we say, oh, does it match? Yep, then we need that packet. So we saw this being used for DHCP for, like, I want to contact a router, I don't know who they are. There's another very common use, which is service discovery. So an example is that you might, you know, if you're configuring a network printer, you might be able to, like, just, you know, click a button and something lists all the printers on your network. And there's other sort of things that are, we generally call service discovery. You know, or like you click a button and it lists all the file shares on your network or something like that. And probably the most common protocol for this is multicast DNS. And as the name suggests, multicast DNS is based on DNS, except it uses multicast. In particular, it is assigned these IP addresses, so 224.0.0.251 in IPv4, and FF02:FB in IPv6 land, and port number 5353 and over UDP, because we can't do multicast usefully over TCP. And as an example, here's a multicast DNS request. So we're sending something that basically looks like a DNS message, where we have a whole lot of questions. The questions have this QM flag to indicate that they're being sent to everybody. And we have these kind of special names to represent. These are services I'm looking for. I'm looking for printers. I'm looking for things that implement something called DNS service discovery. I'm looking for scanners and so on. And for DNS service discovery, we have this extra data about things I'm looking for that is, you can read the DNS service discovery RFC. It seems more complicated than it has to be. And then for getting a response, okay, I should not have zoomed this out as much. You can respond by saying, hey, basically with a, hey, there is a printer. So what we're seeing here is we have and we use the pointer type that, remember, we saw being used for reverse lookups, and sort of we had name.printer.local.tcp.local. And then we have a name. Yeah. TCP. Cool. We have sort of some further records with more information about that. But this is sort of the response that says, there's a printer available for me, you know, with this name. That's the way they've chosen to encode this in DNS. I don't think this is the best, you know, the most intuitive way to do that, but that's what they've chosen to do. But the sort of the key idea is that, you know, we're using this multicast idea, so everyone who implements this service discovery feature can listen for these multicast packets that we see are being sent to everybody here. So this is 224.0.0.251. So everyone can listen to this multicast address if they want to. Some questions on discovery. And there's one other thing that this is used for, is that there's a .local pseudo-domain that is implemented using multicast DNS. So in this case, buzzard.local is advertising, I have an IP address here, which is presumably this one, by just sending out a DNS response saying, hey, buzzard.local in this IP address. And this is used by most machines for the .local domain, so it sort of automatically works. If you have machines configured with a name, they have a server that broadcasts these packets periodically saying, giving this answer for DNS, and or that respond to questions about who's buzzer.local sent on the multicast address, and that lets everyone figure out, figure out name.local without any sort of explicit configuration. You just have a machine called name, it knows how to respond to name.local queries. Okay, and one last thing about sockets. So we saw that they're address families, and I would like to mention just some examples of other address families, and I'll start with the most important one, and then the second most important one, and then there's some miscellaneous ones. The most important one that is actually used is AF Unix, or also called AF Local, but not in Python. And those are sockets that only work on the local machine. So you don't have to assign a port number and use 127.0.0.1. You can get all the socket stuff with these sockets which don't have IP addresses. You could also use the localhost ones, but they also support this. And on Unix, these sockets can be represented as files on disk. They can have a file name. And they can support sending a file descriptor from one process to another. Probably the other very notable one is AF-RAW. If you wonder how Wireshark works, usually that's how tools like Wireshark work, is that there's a special socket type RAW that gives you kind of the RAW, usually Ethernet or Wi-Fi frames. And there's some other types. So other things that the socket API is used for in Linux is that there's some stuff where you make a socket, but rather than the other end being a sort of another normal program, the other end is the kernel on your OS. And AFNetLink is something Linux uses for a lot of network configuration stuff. Things like firewalls and such to communicate between the kernel and a program that's implementing some network services. And there's also some other protocols that historically have been popular and maybe still are used a little bit. So AX25 is a protocol used by amateur radio people, and AppleTalk is what Mac OS before OS X supported for communicating between Macs. And there's some other historical protocols that might still be supported. So questions on our other address families or multicast? Before I move on to our main topic today, which is HTTP. So, HTTP kind of is ubiquitous, and maybe ubiquitous for things that you wouldn't expect. So this is a 2012 piece from Berkeley, my alma mater. Some people I do, fellow students, arguing that HTTP is kind of our new narrow waist. It's not IP anymore, it's HTTP. I don't think this is entirely true, but a lot of this has happened. And there are some features of HTTP that we see that kind of make it, have made it kind of used a lot this way, in that it supports a lot of things that kind of go beyond just showing web pages. And this paper, I believe, was mentioning sort of naming flexibility and indirection as sort of the two most important things it supports. That kind of has those things built in. It also has, I think the third thing they mention is sort of built-in middle box support, which we'll see with proxies. So to talk about HTTP, we should talk first about URLs and URIs. I think this is review from CSO2, but we're going to be doing it. We're going to be using them because that's what HTTP is really tied to. So URLs are going to be the full name. URIs are going to be potentially missing some pieces. They're uniform because we have this sort of one syntax for potentially lots of different protocols, lots of different types of resources. And kind of my set of examples from two, we have a scheme, we have a server, and potentially a port number, and we have a path and a query, and potentially a fragment. And we'll see in HTTP that we're going to send the, we're going to use the server name to contact the server and also send it the server name. We'll talk about why in a bit. We're going to use this path here along with the query, and that's what we're going to ask the server for. And the fragment, when it exists, is not something we're going to actually tell the server about. And we're going to be dealing with HTTP. I'd like you to know that, the URL syntax supports a whole bunch of other types of URLs, but we're not going to be concerned with them right now. Other thing about URIs, so I said URIs are kind of the more general thing, is that in context, like, we can imply parts of the URI. So for example, if you see a link to this URI, that means that we want to use the same scheme we already used. That's why the scheme is okay to omit the scheme. So if I have this on something where I know I'm coming from HTTPS, I know it's HTTPS. If I'm coming from HTTP, I know it's HTTP. If I'm coming from SFTP, I know it's SFTP. That's kind of implied. And here, the host is implied. If I'm coming from foo.com, I know this is foo.com/that. Okay, so that's our general URI syntax. So we have our scheme, what protocol. And so we've seen HTTPS, which is HTTP over TLS instead of TCP, which is the most common. TLS being adding encryption and authentication, basically. And we have what's called the authority, which is our host, or we can have a user or in there, but for HTTP, typically we won't do that. It is supported in HTTP. I'm not actually planning on talking about how it's supported, because that's not how logging into websites in HTTP works. It doesn't use this feature for most websites you're familiar with. And we have a path, which is this part here, a query part, which usually is key value pairs. We'll see an example of like how that works later, and a fragment, which represents a place in some resource. So we'll often call the thing we're getting a resource. That's the HTTP terminology. And kind of the way HTTP usually works is that we're going to connect to an HTTP server, and it's going to send requests that might look something like this. We'll talk about some of the parts of this request. So we'll have a request method. We'll have our path. I see what I did here. There should be a tilde there. We'll have our path, and we'll also have some headers. And we'll respond with a response that has a status code, and also a status message, and some more headers, and potentially some content. So that's sort of what's typical. So that's the general format of our request. So we have a method, we have a URI. So usually, as you've seen here, it's just the path. As we'll see later, there's a case where it can actually be a full, have like a HTTP in it, which is going to be for proxies. And we're going to get a response with a status code and a message. And in both cases, we'll have headers. and we'll have a message body. So here, there's a message body here. This is the sort of data we're sending back. It turns out we can have a message body sometimes on our requests, and sometimes we'll have a response without a message body. So the sort of general format is we have this difference between requests and responses, but the question of is there a message body, that's separate from is it a request or response. That's going to be decided based on the combination of the method or the status code tells us that. And our format in HTTP 1.1, which is the version I've shown so far, it's all ASCII text. It's all over TCP or over TLS for HTTPS. And all new lines use CRLF. So they are 2 bytes. And why did I, oh. So this is hex here. So what you might write is /r/n and C on Unix. And you do fix some formatting. And our requests are generally going to have a method, a URI, HTTP 1.1, have a bunch of headers, and sometimes a message body. And our responses are going to have HTTP1, a status code, and a status message, and sometimes in some headers. Then a message body, and it turns out we can sometimes have a trailer, which are headers at the end. So this is HTTP 1.1, and there's also HTTP 2 and HTTP 3. And you might expect, since we've gone all the way to version 3, that no one's using HTTP 1.1 anymore. That is very not true. There's still a ton of use of HTTP 1.1. But these are kind of new versions, which are designed to mainly be more efficient than HTTP 1.1. So they don't like carry extra information. They're mainly designed to be more efficient. So HTTP 2 is done over TCP. HTTP 3 takes the rather extreme step of not using TCP anymore. It uses a different transport protocol we mentioned briefly when we talked about handshakes called QUIC, or something based on QUIC. And probably the two biggest things that HTTP 2 and 3 do are, one is that they have a binary format that is much more compact. So using all this ASCII text is really nice because it's like really easy to debug, but it's not compact, right? We're typing out our various headers here, so like we're typing out content type over and over again on every connection, and if we're getting lots of little images, that actually kind of adds up. So they have this sort of much more compact binary format with compression support, and they support multiple streams in one connection. So even though we have one TCP connection, they divide up, they send out these, what they call frames in the TCP connection that kind of let us have multiple connections over that one TCP connection for HTTP 2, or for HTTP 3, multiple connections over that one sort of set of UDP, stream of UDP packets. And a thing they do is they kind of normalize the syntax. So it's like kind of awkward here that our request and response formats are almost the same. Almost the same, but they're not quite the same. And HTTP 2 and 3 just fix that by encoding the method, status code, and URI as special headers. So everything's a header or the body. And they don't have any... And so we don't have any sort of difference between requests and responses as far as message format anymore. Or they're just, you know, a request just has certain headers, a response doesn't have. So here's kind of a real example of HTTP 1.1. So this is sent by a copy of Chrome. And we can see we have a whole lot of headers. So I showed you some, but we have a whole lot that a typical web browser will send. So here, and we have our response. And in this case, we can see that we actually are sending back our response as gzip. So it's in compressed, and that's why this is not readable here, even though it's HTML. And if you know HTML, you know HTML usually is something that you could kind of read. And as for HTTP2, so here's a connection from an undisclosed source address to Wikipedia over IPv6. We can see that as decoded, we have this sort of frame of headers for stream ID 15. So I mentioned it supports multiple streams. So in this case, this is stream ID 15 within that single connection because we have these multiple streams. And you can see we have these pseudo headers here for the request. So rather than having the get and the path and all that URI being sent specially, they're just these special headers which start with a colon. And that's how we encode that information in HTTP2 and HTTP3 rather than doing the normal. Okay, so we've looked at kind of the HTTP format, and I mentioned that there's these methods, and we've only seen get. So let's talk about the HTTP methods. So we have, this is a selected list. There are in fact more. And we have get and head are kind of our most obvious ones. So get retrieves some resource. So like gets a web page's contents or an image. And the method tells us whether we have a request and response body, primarily. It tells us whether we have a request body. So the method says, should there be a request body or not? In HTTP1, this is what we have to, this is something we need to pay attention to for parsing the message. So for get and head, there's never a request body, but we have these other methods that have a reason to have a request body. So post is for providing data to the server in some way. Put is for setting the contents of a resource. Delete is for deleting a resource. And options, and there's several more methods you might find in use that are less important. And when the server responds to these methods, so usually, it will respond to a get request with a body, and often it will respond to these other ones with a body, with something, some information as that request body that's not just in headers. For head, we have the special case that we don't do it. And I have this column here marked safe, and that's actually the term that's used by the HTTP standard. So some of these methods are safe and some of them are not. So what does it mean for a method to be safe or unsafe? So a safe method is one that you can just send unprompted and repeat and it's fine. But for the other methods, that's not okay. If we're sending data to a server or deleting something or setting the contents of a resource, we should not just automatically do that. And a big case where this comes up is, let's say I am in a web browser and I press the back button. We don't want to redo one of these other methods like post. And in fact, in Firefox, if you ask it to do something where it needs to actually refetch the data, it will give you a message like this, and other web browsers will do similar. We'll say, hey, I don't have this data and I can't get it again without redoing something. And so if you're doing something on a web server, this is important to be aware of because you want to make sure that if you let have something being done via a GET request or a HEAD request, that it's okay for like web for clients like web browsers to just do that randomly at random times that you don't expect. If there's something that you don't want to have happen that way, like the things Firefox suggests here, like repeating an order, you probably want to not use the GET method. Because that's the contract, is that clients will just do that randomly without user being prompted. So post method. So we have this sort of post for providing data. And one thing that this is used for is that if you take the quiz for this class, it sends post requests. When you press a button, that's how it's recorded on the server. So there's some script in this page that makes the web browser send a post request with some JSON to a particular URL. And so that's an example of sort of providing data to the server. So this is not a fetching a resource operation. And there is a response to this post request. So there is a response which tells the script, was this actually recorded successfully or not? That's used to make the box turn green or not green. And we want to do this via post because we don't want web browsers sort of automatically repeating your quiz responses, right? We want to say that that's not okay, and we want to also provide this body, which we can't do in a GET request. Now, we could use forms that, we could have sort of submissions of sort of requests that are specific that use a GET request. So something we can do is like, rather than encoding our data in the request body, we can encode it in the URI. And this is in fact done all the time. So you can have forms in HTML. And kind of GET and POST usage is kind of mostly designed around this because historically, like web browsers didn't support scripting. So if you wanted to take forms, you have to deal with what HTML supported. So here I have an HTML form where I say, hey, I'd like to have you make a request to example.com/foo, and I'd like you to use the GET method, and we're gonna have a name and a query here, so I can enter a name and a query, and I press submit, and that doesn't need to make a post request, it makes a GET request. Here. And based on our rules for what methods are safe, is that a GET request has to be safe, right? This has to be something where the web browser can just resend this request over and over again. So this isn't something I'd want to use for like making an order, but it's fine to use for like searching for something, right? It's fine to like redo a search randomly. It's not fine to like redo, send, order something randomly. And we also see, we can also have our forms that do posts, and kind of the kind of default encoding here is that we have send a content type of www form URL encoded here, and we have just this particular way of encoding all our submission here. So here I'm submitting name is some name, and comment is this comment in several lines. And we see there's this sort of standard way of encoding that. So the recipient knows where all the field boundaries are and so on. And it's called URL encoded because the encoding is actually the same one we used here. So basically the GET method encodes something, copies it in the URL, the POST method just does the same encoding, just puts it in the request body. Something else we can see is that when I'm sending this, I send a content length, and that's kind of really necessary because we want to know where is the end of the request, And this is how the server is going to tell in HTTP 1.1. In HTTP 2 and HTTP 3, we have these framing frames, so we can do that in a better way. And you might say, look at this and say, you know, I've uploaded like web files on web pages. Does that work with this? And the answer is not really. So there's this alternate encoding called multi-part form data that is considerably more verbose, but is what you need to do file uploads, basically. And as I've expressed things so far, like, it, you know, so we have this get and post. So get, you know, we saw, like, it's safe, but that means it's going to work with the back button, which post will deliberately not. And it also works, as we'll see later, with caches, which post really won't. And there's another issue with get requests that kind of make it, you know, mean that you might see get not used even when it would be appropriate otherwise, which is that it's limited by the URL size, that there's actually going to be a size limit. HTTP doesn't precisely say it, but if you're trying to fit like kilobytes of data in the URL, it probably won't work. So if you want to send a lot of data, you have to use post even though you'd rather have something that works more like get. And post requests basically have no real size limits. With get requests, we have this advantage that since it's in the URL, you can save the URL, copy paste the URL, and it won't and it access it again. Sometimes that's considered a disadvantage. So there's some cases where people use post, even though a get request would be fine. Otherwise, because they don't want the information in the URL, they don't want it showing on the screen, they don't want it in the browser history, that sort of thing. So they've decided not to use a post request. And with get, like, we can only really have text fields. With post, you can actually do that form data. OK, so let's do a little exercise since we know about get and post. What is the write request method to use if you're running a web server and you want to serve an image with a clock with the current time? Oh, something for rating a product and getting the summary of all the ratings after you do that. A search query for something like Twitter and getting the second page of some search results. So let's start with our first one. Who thinks that for that image, it would be best to do via a get? Who thinks it would be best to do via a post? Okay, so anyone want to defend either of those? Yeah?
Something post because you don't want it to cache. Every time you would refresh it, you want it updated within the current button.
Okay, so you're thinking post because we don't want it to cache. Okay, so that's a good thought. As we'll learn later, there are different, better ways we have of making things not cacheable that are independent of the method. Yeah?
I was thinking mainly for size of an image, maybe a larger size that Git might not be able to handle.
Oh, so you're saying the image would be a larger size. Oh, sorry, I'm assuming for sending to the browser. Does that change people's answers? But indeed, if the browser was sending an image, yeah, we don't want to use get. We don't want to put the image in the URI. So if we're sending to a browser, I think get is the better choice. So caching is a legitimate concern. We're going to have ways with headers. Basically, you can set headers to control the caching. And that's how we'll solve that problem. How about rating a product and then showing the summary of ratings afterwards? Who thinks that we should use get for this? Post? No clue? So some no clues. I would say post because rating a product, we don't want this automatically redone. And an example of why this would be problematic in practice is, let's say I write a product 4 stars and then 5 stars, and then I press the back button a couple times. We want to make sure that that pressing the back button doesn't make it go back to 4 stars without the user being prompted. So I would say that this is, that the second one I think is best as a post for that reason. The other thing is that sometimes browsers might like do GET requests kind of proactively, like to speed things up. We don't want the browser like saying, oh, like let's try to speed this up by getting this thing and before you get access it. We don't want to do that if that's going to rate something. How about for our search query? Who thinks we should use a GET request, a POST request? Okay. So I think as long as the search query isn't huge, we should use a GET request. GET unless sort of a big search, sort of complicated, you know, unless, you know, very complicated search. So if the search query, like if we're specifying like 100 different things for a search, yes. But for a Twitter-like website, that's not supported, so probably just GET. How about for getting the second page of some search results? So we see the first page, we wanted to go to the second page. Who thinks we should use a GET request for this? A POST request? Something else? Someone want to defend either answer? Okay, so typically you see GET request use. I think that's the better choice. Now this has the awkwardness that then we kind of need to be able to get the second page of results out of nowhere, right? That we're gonna need to be able to request, give me page 2 of the results for University of Virginia. But that's typically what people end up implementing, because that like works better with like back buttons and things like that, like to actually support that functionality. Now, if you have a notion that like we're computing something complicated and you know when you go to the second page that's gonna prevent you from seeing us from tracking the first page again or something like that, maybe you do something different. But you know, if we're not changing anything on the server to get the second page of the results, like if there's no actual change, we're just like fetching the results and only showing you the second page of them, then that's fine. And that's typically how multi-page search queries are implemented, because HTTP, like each request is kind of independent of each other. Okay. So some other things with HTTP. So if you look at es.wikipedia.org, it has this IPv6 address. en.wikipedia.org has this IPv6 address. ES is Spanish Wikipedia. EN is English Wikipedia. They're obviously different websites. So how does that work? And the answer is that we have a host or authority header, depending which HTTP version we're doing. And HTTP clients always send this header, so our server can identify which version of the web page to show, to respond with. This is sometimes called virtual host, because we have one IP address, but it represents multiple different actual websites. Okay, so that's on the sending request. So we have these status codes, and the status codes are kind of grouped by kind of what they're about. So we have our 1 is informational, 2 something is success, you know, okay, or like no content is an example of another 200 code. 3 is kind of redirection. 4 is that the client did something wrong, like you tried to access something you're not allowed to access, or you tried to access something that doesn't exist. And 5 is the server did something wrong. So that's sort of the hierarchy of codes. There are names for these codes, but the numbers are what, you know, matters for anything that's like checking, like, did I actually get this web page or not, sort of thing. And redirects deserve some special mention. So redirects have a location header. that says where to actually go to, and most HTTP clients will follow this automatically. There is some content in the page, and that might be displayed if an HTTP client doesn't support redirects, or maybe if following the redirect doesn't work. It will display that content. So there is a still a response body for these redirects. It just, you know, typically you don't see it. And there's a bunch of types of redirects that, and there's one kind of special case in redirect, is that if we have a post request, do we redirect that to another URL? And the answer HTTP has chosen is you don't, is that most redirects turn into GET requests when you post or put them, with the exception of 308. But most of them turn into GET requests, because usually the way that works is, like, I post a rating, and when there's a redirect, I should get some page after I posted the rating, is kind of the notion. So to support that functionality, redirects typically turn other requests into GET requests. The error codes, they can have full web page, full like documents returned from them. Like the status code for like a web browser, they'll just display the page there the same way they do it for a successful response. You know, there's nothing like necessarily special about how the web server treats it. Now, one puzzle you might have here is, what are informational status codes? Like, what could that possibly be for? And there's one that's used sometimes called 100 continue. And the motivation for this is that after they standardized HTTP 1.1, they noticed this kind of annoyance that we could like make a post request where we're spending a lot of data. And we might find out after sending, you know, our several gigabytes of data, oops, you typoed there. That's not the right thing, or you're not logged in, sorry. And that's kind of annoying. So to mitigate this, HTTP 1.1 came up with this idea of the 100 continue code, where the idea is that when we make a request, we put this header saying, I expect 100 continue. And I will get any error response immediately before I send my request body if I do that. And if there is no error, instead, I will get a 100 continue response telling me, there's no error yet, at least. Why don't you send your request body? Now, there's a problem with this, which means that it's probably not really used. And the problem is that, like, the theory is the reason we have this expect 100 continue header is that, like, every server is going to check for that, and you either implement this feature, you know, or, you know, going to respond immediately. And what you're supposed to do is you're supposed to, you know, if you don't support 100 continue, you're supposed to respond with expectation failed, so then the client can at least retry. But what you have to kind of do in practice is that some web servers don't support this at all. They just don't know about it. So you kind of like send your request, you wait a while, and then nothing happens, and then you just hope that you would have gotten an error response by now. It's not good. But that was the theory. That's why the 100 status codes, you know, that is the use that exists, but it's a little impractical unless you know the server supports it in advance. So, talked about making requests, what the requests are for. Let's talk about making multiple requests. So, we saw in our first example that we can have multiple requests for each connection. And this is actually a feature that didn't exist in the earliest versions of HTTP. In the earliest versions of HTTP, you had to make one connection for every request response pair. And we've seen that this kind of evolved to supporting multiple streams in a connection, HTTP 2 and HTTP 3. But HTTP 1.1 has these sort of two ways it supports sort of NOR requests without going to that extreme. So one is this notion of persistent connections, which you've seen is that after one request and response, we can have another one. And another is this idea called pipelining, we'll talk about later, where basically we can send multiple requests before we receive any response. So one issue that we had here is when we went from HTTP 1.0 to 1.1, we need to figure out how long are requests, responses. And the answer in the original version of HTTP was that it can be determined by a content length field or by closing the connection. So this works, but it has the major disadvantage that, you know, if we want to generate a document dynamically and we don't know how long it is in advance, we either have to generate the whole thing and then write the content length header and then send the document, or not use persistent connections. So that's kind of annoying. So HTTP 1.1 has this solution to it known as chunked transfer coding, where we can say we're using this chunk transfer coding, and we can send a length of a chunk of data, send that data, send another length of a chunk of data, terminated by a length of zero. And in this way, we don't need to compute the length at the beginning. We can still generate things on the fly. And we can still keep the connection open because the client reading from us can tell when the end of the response is. Questions on chunk transfer coding? Okay, so we also have mentioned pipelining. So in pipelining, something a client can do is a client can just send requests, multiple requests, without receiving all the responses. And this is faster than just sending one of them. So it's something that web browsers like doing. And the idea is that actually this is pretty much free for the server to do, handle, because as far as the server is concerned, it's just accepting, it's just, you know, more requests, it can handle them, it will just handle them normally anyways. You know, its code basically doesn't change. And if the server is maybe really clever, it can actually do better than that. It could potentially read two requests and process them in parallel, but it has to respond to them in order. Now, a challenge with doing pipelining is that because you have to deal with what happens if you get this response and then you get, instead of getting these, you get connection close. In that case, you need to realize, I don't have a response for the next two things because the connection was closed. And also, if any of those were post requests or something, you don't know if they happened because maybe the connection closed due to a network problem. So you need to handle sort of extra requests. Now, that's pipelining. So HTTP 2, as I mentioned, and 3, support multiple streams. So here's my Wireshark from, again, HTTP 2 with Wikipedia. We can see we send a GET request for /wiki. We get a 301 move permanently response. We send a GET request for main page. We get the data. And then we realize, there's all these things we have to load in order to display the main page. So we just make a whole bunch of different requests, and the numbers here are that they're on stream 19, 21, 23, 25, 27, 29 within this one TCP connection for each of these things. And that means that we can kind of receive the headers and data for each of these independently and interleave whenever the server has it ready for us. Okay, so questions? So one other thing that HTTP supports is something called content negotiation. So we've kind of looked at our request as we're getting a specific thing. But HTTP was designed with this notion that because we have these request headers, we can tailor what we respond with for our particular client. And so, for example, when Firefox contacts Wikipedia, it gives this list of here are the formats that I would like to get. And it's actually a preference order, text HTML, application XML, and less preferred with a preference level of 0.9 is application XML, and then there's a full list of several of these. And also, there's something similar for language. I would prefer to get stuff in English, US English or English. And also for encoding. I would like things that are compressed with gzip, dflate, br, or zstandard. And the idea is that the server can look at these fields and choose what to give back based on that. And this seems like a neat idea. The current HTTP standard doesn't like it. They just say it has several disadvantages, very diplomatically. Because they think it's hard for the server to know what's actually best for the client, even though we're not communicating enough information precisely. It has some privacy issues, like my web browser is broadcasting my language preferences all the time. And it also has some issues with caching. Okay. Questions on content negotiation? So their advice is that if you want to do this, you should have the client choose in some way rather than having the server choose which version and have different URLs for each of the versions, probably. Okay, so let's talk about state. So we looked at HTTP, we have our requests, and we have ways of making lots of requests together. But even when we're making kind of all these different requests, each of them is independent of each other, right? Each of them could be in a separate connection for all we care. There's no the advantage of having them all in one connection is just efficiency. There's nothing that actually connects these requests together. So in this sense, we say HTTP is stateless, that each request kind of stands on its own. There's no actual connection between any pair of requests. You know, yeah, they might be sent on the same connection, but they're processed independently of each other. And this is a problem, actually, for things we expect to happen on websites. Login functionality kind of assumes that my login request and the next time I visit the website are connected. But we see HTTP doesn't support that. And the mechanism that was kind of added on top of HTTP to support that is cookies. And the idea of cookies is that a server sends to a client a header saying, I'd like you to set this cookie, this information I'm going to have you store, and the client will send that back on a later request to the server. And most commonly, the cookie will hold what is commonly known as a session ID, which is basically some number we can look up in a database to query all our other information. We can actually put other sorts of information there, but most commonly you'll see just this ID that's a key for a database on the server. And we can see here that these cookies actually support some attributes here. So we can specify what domains should a client send the cookie back for. So for example, if domain is example.com, then you know we'll send it for example.com and also subdomains of example.com. We can mark it as only to be sent back in TLS. We can mark it not to be exposed to web space scripts. And we can also set time limits on the cookie. If you don't, it's until browser closed is usually kind of what most HTTP clients use, something like until the client is closed. And you know, generally, we're sending back the cookie to the web server we originally got it from. So this is, you know, for database, for login, like this is pretty natural, right? We log into a website, that website has set a cookie that reflects our login, it can look up in a database and say, oh, that cookie has login. But something you've probably heard of cookies being used for is tracking. And this might be confusing because I told you we set a cookie and we receive back the same cookie. And like that's not the sort of tracking people are concerned about. They're concerned about being tracked across different websites. But if I can only set a cookie for example.com, you know, how can example.com track you on other websites? What's happening there? And the problem is that websites load data from other websites. So something we can do is we can have, say, a bunch of websites include an image from, say, tracker.com, and maybe have the name of the website encoded in that image name. Tracker.com now knows, now can read a cookie there and can know the same user, even though these are otherwise independent requests, you know, visited Foo, Bar, and Quacks, because that's why this image would be loaded. And we can kind of extend this to pass other information between websites by just encoding more stuff in the URL. Okay, I was gonna do an exercise on cookie tracking, but I probably will skip that to briefly talk about caching. So questions on right here. We'll do that exercise next time. Okay, so I mentioned caching earlier as something we'll do, and the caching is going to look pretty similar to what we saw in DNS. We're going to have some little additions. So like DNS, we're going to have, you know, the big problem we're going to have to solve is how do we tell if something's out of date? We have some extra problem that content negotiation and cookies and things like that mean that, well, how do I make sure I'm not using a cached version that like doesn't work anymore because like it's the wrong language for my accept language? So for the is it out of date information, we have an option that's familiar to us from what we saw in DNS, which is that we're gonna just set a time. It's gonna be valid for this many seconds. We're gonna have a second option, which is that we can check with the server if it's changed. That's not something we had in DNS. In DNS, we just get a new copy of it. But with like a web page, we don't want to get a whole web page, but it still might be worth contacting the server to say, do I need a new web page or a new image? So for checking if something has changed, we have two options here. We can set this expires header. When we do that, we have to supply a date because the client's time might be different than the server's. Or we have this much more usable where we can set a cache control header with a max age value. And that's max age works pretty much like the time to live in DNS. It's a number of seconds. So that's our kind of simplest option. Another option is that we can check with the server if the values change. And this uses what we'll call conditional gets. So let's say I get this struct.html page, and the server might tell me, hey, this was last modified at this time and has this etag, which stands for entity tag, this tag. What I can do with either of those pieces of information independently is I can make, when I make my guest request, I can say, get this thing if it's modified since this time, or if it doesn't match this. And either of these, you can use these independently. Sometimes browsers will try both and just see which one works. And basically, if this says we don't actually need a new version of this, the server will just respond with, rather than a new copy of the file, it will just respond with 304 not modified and no data. And we know our cached version is fine. Questions on this? So this is in seconds. Okay. So the other issue we had is, how do we know when, if we have this content negotiation idea or cookies, how do we know that whether we can use a cache thing or not? And there is a header called vary, which tells the client, hey, when you're caching this, your request needs to have the same value for these headers in order for you to use it. So typically what they'll do is that they'll see, can I show the cached version? They'll say, do the headers match what I got used when I got the cached version for accept and accept language and cookie? The answer is yes, we can use it. If you've changed your language preferences since then, for example, with accept language, the answer is no. With this header, if the cookies have changed, cookie value, the session ID has changed, no. And so this is how we provide information to let us cache things, even though what's at a particular URL will vary. So there are also some other cache control settings. We saw max age equals x for x seconds. This is also how you turn off caching. So our common problem with the image that showed a clock that you were worried that it was going to change all the time, you don't want to cache it, we can say no store. Or we can set a max age of 1. And that will keep it from being cached. There's also no cache. It's not the same as no store. No cache means do a conditional get, check with the server if it's up to date, which is not the same as no store. And there's this private and public for is it acceptable to put on a shared cache? So we could potentially have an organization that has one cache for many people. The private and public are for that scenario. Yes?
Yeah, so you just said that no store would basically be the same thing as max age equal to 1 functionally, but is there a difference to where it actually still caches it, but just instantly expires?
So the question is, no store the same as max age equal to, would be the same as max age equal to 1 functionally? So it wouldn't be the same because it says do not store. Mm-hmm. So with max age equal to 1, we could still do these conditional gets for it. Because we'd store a copy and we check if the copy is still up to date. So I guess something that's subtle here is that in seconds, before we need to check if up to date. So the max age says how long is it until we have to check with the server? It doesn't say you have to discard it after that time. Thank you for bringing it up. It's a very important point. So the advantage of having this kind of this way of validating our cache is that we can kind of not rely on the time to live to expire things, which means we can just keep things around and say, I had this thing from a month ago, is it still okay? Even though it's pretty unlikely that someone's going to say, please display the thing from a month ago without asking me. That answer your question? Okay, and I guess I'm out of time, so we'll finish up HTTP stuff next time, including going over some other issues with caches and talking about proxies, which are basically an HTTP server you contact to contact other HTTP servers.